So it's a pleasure to be speaking here at this wonderful conference. What I'll be talking about is basically models for complex networks as well as models for processes on them. And the processes that I'll be having in mind are information diffusion processes. So think about first passage percolation or shortest path routing or these kind of things. But also I'll be speaking a little bit about competition processes where you have different species running on a graph and trying to grab as much of the territory as possible. But I'll start a little bit with some of the motivation as to why we're interested in networks and what the properties are of these networks that we will be trying to model. So these are two, I find, pretty pictures of complex networks. This is a picture of the internet topology. It's an artistic representation. And this is a very famous picture about the interactions between proteins in yeast. And you can imagine that every edge that you see here corresponds to a certain interaction of two proteins. And that actually means that these proteins are interacting in a chemical reaction. One could be a catalyst for a reaction that the other is involved in, or one could turn into the other, or something like that. So you can imagine how much biological research goes into creating a graph like this. For every edge, you need to have some sort of a chemical reaction that the two different proteins are involved in. So these are our two pictures. And one of the things that you can see, or maybe cannot see because of the resolution, is that these pictures tend to be highly inhomogeneous, in the sense that you have vertices with a very small degree, and you also have rare, but they are there, vertices with very high degrees. And if we think about the simplest imaginable model for a random graph, that's the Erdős-Rényi random graph, there you do not see the same amount of variability of the degrees or the number of connections that the vertices have. So that means that we'll have to model these graphs in a different way, and that's actually the main topic of my talk. Now, one of the things that is quite peculiar is that you have all of these networks that come from all sorts of different applications: internet, biology, social networks, think about Facebook, the World Wide Web, sort of all different applications. But still, these networks that you get out, they have things in common. And that's, at least for me, it sparks my interest into why this is. And also, it offers us mathematicians the opportunity to build models that will not only apply to the biological setting, but maybe also to other settings. Okay? So there's a lot of attention on this, well, at least for me, somewhat unexpected commonality. So let me describe what this commonality is. Oh, no, wrong way around. So the first thing is that these models tend to be highly variable in the sense that you have occasional vertices that have very high degrees, but the majority of the vertices has actually a relatively small degree. So on average, the degree is some finite number, but if you look at the vertex with the largest degree, this degree can actually be pretty large. So here on the left, we see an example from the Internet Movie Database, and in this network, the vertices correspond to actors, and you connect two actors with one another when they've played in the same movie. Okay? So that means that the degree here is something like a collaboration degree. That's the amount of actors that these actors have collaborated with. Okay? So you see that the majority, these are all in log-log scale, so actually the bulk of the graph is somewhere here on the top, and the majority of people have maybe played with, let's say, up to 100 other actors. But actually in the tail, you see people who've collaborated with 10 to the power of 5, which is 100,000 different actors, which is quite a bit, right? And you can imagine maybe that these people probably play a significant role in the structure of the network. So if we were to do something similar for mathematicians, which we can also do, that's called the Erdős Number Project. And in the Erdős Number Project, what you do is you connect two mathematicians with one another when they've collaborated on a paper. And then you see a picture that is not as extensive as here, but you do see a picture where the highest degree is pretty large. And that's actually, that highest degree corresponds to Erdős, and he has something like 510 collaborators, which is a lot compared to, let's say, the average number of collaborators that that an average mathematician has. By the way, we did some research on this with students, and it's a lot of fun just looking at MathSciNet and trying to figure out what the degrees of people are. You can't just get that information out. There's lots of tools, and also about graph distances. And certainly I have had to change my picture of what a random mathematician is. A random mathematician is not somebody like us. A random mathematician is probably some master student who has been a co-author on maybe one paper corresponding to his master project, and that's it. Right, so there's lots of mathematicians who have degree maybe one, or some even have degree zero, and that's actually a large proportion in the graph. So it's a lot of fun doing these kind of more practical investigations. So this here is the Internet Movie Database. Of course, this is more like a fun example. Right, it's also sometimes called a Kevin Bacon game. Here on the right is something that is maybe a bit more profound, and this is degree distribution in the Internet. Now, there's a lot of research going into how does one actually get these numbers out. That's not very easy. This is done through an algorithm which is called Traceroute, and there's a lot of debate as to whether these pictures are actually correct or whether there's lots of errors there. And these debates really are rather fundamental between the people who know about the Internet and the people who are actually doing the measurements. This is quite fascinating. Now, in any case, what is being empirically noted is that in many of these sequences, when you plot them in a log-log scale, you see something that resembles a straight line, like here or like here. Now, a straight line in a log-log plot corresponds to a parallel in a real plot. So that actually means that if I look at the proportion pk of vertices having degree k, that satisfies that this actually is something like an inverse power of k. And then indeed, when you take the log of this, what you see is that the log of pk is in linear relationship with the log of k. And that's what explains these straight lines and the relation to these power laws. And the good thing about this is that not only can you sort of visually inspect whether something is close to a power law, whether this is a power law is not so clear, but this seems to be relatively nicely approximated by it. But it also gives you the opportunity to actually compute or estimate what the exponent is. Because that's just the slope of this graph. Okay? And this has been done for lots of network examples. And empirically what you see is that very often power law exponents in between 2 and 3 are being reported. Sometimes they're larger than 3, and sometimes there's no power law at all. For example, Facebook degrees does not have a power law, because there's also restrictions as to how many friends you're allowed to have. So, but the main message here is that you see a high amount of variability, and you have these rare nodes in your graph that have a very high degree. And probably these nodes are quite important, just like Erdős was quite important in the math community. Right. Oh. Now, the second thing that many of these networks satisfy is that they tend to be small worlds. And small worlds basically means the following. If I have a network, what I can do is I can pick two vertices uniformly at random, and I can look at how far away they are from each other in the network. So that's sometimes called the intrinsic distance or the graph distance. And it just is the minimum number of hops that you need to take to go from the source to your destination. So in any network, this is a random variable, because you're taking a random pair and you're checking what the distance is between this random pair, and therefore you can make a plot of what the probability mass function is. And plots of this kind are given here. This is for the strongly connected component in the World Wide Web, and this is for the Internet Movie Database in 2003. And one of the things that you see is that these distances tend to be relatively small. And this is closely related to what is in the social networking called 6 degrees of separation. So 6 degrees of separation would correspond to a graph distance that is 7. And what you see is that the majority here is less than or equal to 7, and here as well. So this is closely related to that. And the funny thing is that these networks can be pretty big. Here we're talking about something like a million actors. But these graph distances are very small. So that's why these are called small worlds. Okay. Now, of course, the prime example of a network is Facebook. Facebook is huge, and the big advantage of Facebook is that actually it's a virtual network, so you have all the data available, at least when Facebook gives it to you. And actually Facebook did give it to some computer scientists who investigated the structure of this network. So at the time that they investigated, which was sometime in 2011, there were 721 million active users and about 70 billion friendship links. And you can imagine that it's actually pretty difficult to investigate structural properties of such a network because it's just humongous. This is the main reason why these are computer scientists who were trying to test algorithms, for example, for finding the diameter in a graph. That's not so easy when the graph is that big. Now what you see is that the typical distances in the Facebook graph are of the order 4. So 4 degrees of separation. And also it turns out to be relatively homogeneous, which is something that I hadn't quite expected. So here are two pictures. This is the same picture as we've seen before for the Internet Movie Database, for example. So graph distances between pairs of vertices. And what you see is that somehow almost everything is less than or equal to 5, so that's 4 degrees of separation. And actually you can also do the same arithmetic to certain subgraphs of Facebook. And what they did was they investigated Italy, Sweden, and the US. Actually, they also investigated the union of Italy and Sweden, but I've tossed those out because I didn't quite understand why that would be useful. And what you see is that these pictures actually are relatively similar to this. So it seems that geometry, at least at this level, does not play a very important role, at least in this network. Okay? All right. So how does one go about modeling this? Yes?
Is that picture on the right, when you say Italy, do you mean deleting everybody who's not in Italy, or just... So it's not the distance between someone in Italy and someone in the U.S.?
No, I thought it was really the subgraph of people who were listing themselves to be Italian.
Okay.
Now, of course, so is my PhD student, who is Italian, but he's located in the Netherlands, is he counted or not? I really don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's a good question. All right. Of course, modeling such networks is not very easy. And there's tons of different models that you can write down. And in fact, this has been done. So there's a lot of research effort into coming up with good models for explaining certain properties of networks and then analyzing these models. And also, more recently, there's a lot of effort going into, let's say, more statistical analysis of such networks, trying to estimate parameters and these kind of things. And we've seen quite a few talks about sort of specific problems related to this. For example, community detection and these kind of things. Now, the kind of models that I will be talking about are really caricature models of reality. But still, they teach us something. So what are the kind of models that I'll be interested in? Well, on a very high level, you can divide them up into two different classes. And the first class are what are called the static models. So you have a network of a certain size, you see that as a snapshot in time, and you try to model that. Okay? So Erdős-Rényi random graph is an example of that. So Erdős-Rényi random graph is a very simple model for a network where you're saying, if you give me the number of vertices in the graph, and if you give me the number of edges in the graph, I can compute what the right value of P should be, and then the Erdős-Rényi random graph with that P I see as a statistical model for the network at hand. Now that's not going to be a very good model because it doesn't have a high amount of variability for the degrees. And we see that these real-world networks actually do have a high amount of variability for the degrees, so we have to do something different. We have to somehow build in inhomogeneity in the graph. Okay? And this can be done in several ways. We've already seen the configuration model, but more in the setting where all the degrees are the same, so still no inhomogeneity. But that's not necessary. You can actually choose these degrees to be relatively flexible. Another thing that you could do is investigate inhomogeneous random graph. There's a beautiful paper by Bolobosh, Janssen, and Reardon, something like 120 pages or so, that investigate these models in a great amount of detail. And so basically this is an attempt of extending the Erdős-Rényi random graph to deal with inhomogeneity in a sparse setting, as we say. So a sparse setting means that the average degree in the graph is actually bounded. So these are two examples. I will not talk about inhomogeneous random graphs today, but I will do so tomorrow in a spatial context. I will be talking about the configuration model, and I will spend a few words also on a dynamic model, and this is called the preferential attachment model. And in the preferential attachment model, the inhomogeneity is basically arising through time. So vertices come in one by one. The vertices that come in the earliest have the highest chance of actually grabbing a large proportion of the degrees. So what you see is that the degrees of the initial vertices tend to be quite large. And all of these models can be tuned to such a way that you get parallel degree sequences, so scale-free behavior. And that's what I'll be focusing on. Now, of course, if I put on my physics hat, which I sometimes do, I have here three models for basically the same thing. Now, it would be very bad if these models would behave completely differently, right? If I have two models for water, and one predicts that there will not be a vapor ever, and the other model predicts that there will be a vapor at some point, then I trust the second model better. But in any case, I mean, it's clear that one of the models has to be wrong. Maybe both of them are wrong, but certainly one of them has to be wrong. So that's, of course, also the question here in random graph theory. If I come up with a list of 25 very nice models, but they behave completely differently, how should I interpret that when I want to compare this to the real world? Okay, so that's sometimes called universality in physics, and it's a property that I find quite important. All right, so the configuration model, we've basically already seen this. This is the description. One comment here, I'll be looking at a situation where the degrees are different. And in fact, they can be highly different. So the largest degree will be much, much larger than the average degree, for example. That's my setting. And this is the description in words. I have an animation of this. Here I have a graph of size 6, 6 vertices, and I'm indicating the degrees with these half edges that are attached to the vertices. And as Nick was describing, what you have to do is create a matching between these half edges in order to create the graph. So let's do that. I start with the one here, and I give it a uniform partner. It turns out to be one of the half edges incident to V3. And then I declare that to be an edge. And then I continue with the second one here, and I match it. And I continue. Okay, and now it's done. Now this doesn't quite look like a network yet, because all of these lines are curved, and typically we don't draw graphs that way. So this is the graph that we've gotten. Okay? And this is the whole procedure of generating the configuration model. Now of course, there's two problems here. The first problem that we have is, you know, when I match uniformly, it could very well be that one of these half edges that is incident to vertex 3 is being matched to one of its sibling half edges, and then you create a self loop. That's possible. We're not ruling that out. Okay? Another problem that might occur is, so we've had this first half edge between V1 and V4. The second one could, again, attached to a half edge incident to V4, and then we have a multiple edge. So these things do happen, but they're relatively rare. So there are several ways how you can go about dealing with this, and Nick was the advocate of one of them that works really well for random regular graphs. What you can just do is, you know, look at your realization. If it has any self loops or multiple edges, throw it away and restart. That will work. Not always, though. I mean, in the settings that I'm talking about, where you have a high amount of inhomogeneity, if you have vertices with very high degree, it may be very likely that they actually have self-loops. Well, in that sense, I would advocate the simpler solution of just throwing away all the mess that you're having. So basically merging all the self-loops, throwing away all the self-loops, merging all the multiple edges, and this will give you a graph that has basically the same degree distribution as your original graph. This is sometimes called the erased configuration model. And the other example is sometimes called the repeated configuration model. Now, the nice thing about this model is that when you condition on simplicity, you actually get a uniform random graph with that degree sequence. So this is a beautiful example of what is called the probabilistic method. That's actually one of the nicest that I know in this area. So this really gives you an opportunity not only to construct one, which is not so simple if you think about it, but also to compute all sorts of properties of, let's say, graphs with a certain degree sequence. For example, how many do you have? So we've seen that example already in Nick's talk, and this works much more generally. Yeah?
Is there a similar statement for the erase model?
A similar statement of what?
For the model where...
No, that's not uniform. Is that the question?
Yes. So if you erase...
It is uniform if you don't erase anything.
Right, but if you...
But if you do erase, then it's not uniform.
And it's not close to... There's no statement where it's close to uniform itself.
What does it mean to be close?
Yeah, asking you...
Okay. Well, good question. There is some work on it, but let me comment on that a little later.
Well, for one thing, not every degree sequence is realizable.
Yes, that's a very good point, of course. Yeah, but I'm in the setting where actually they are, at least when the sum of the degrees is even. I'm assuming that. And then, I mean, basically, problems arise when you have degrees that are extremely large, let's say, over the order n, and I will never have that situation. So there will be realizable simple graphs, but it's just that the configuration model doesn't happen to find them. All right. Now, this is actually only one of the problems. The second problem that you might be worried about is that I was starting here with this half edges on the top, and I was actually going clockwise to match them. But why? I mean, is there really something special about vertex 1? I mean, in many of the real-world examples, there's no speciality of any of the vertices. Right? So there's no vertex 1. Now, the nice thing about this construction is that it actually doesn't matter. I could have started at V4 and gone sort of counterclockwise. It doesn't matter because it's a uniform matching. So the process of pairing the half edges is completely exchangeable, and therefore the order doesn't matter. That's good. So it's even allowed to do this randomly. And this is actually very convenient if you're trying to explore the graph. So suppose I want to know the neighborhood of vertex 1. Well, then I'll be starting by pairing the half edges that are incident to vertex 1, but then maybe from their neighbors I would want to continue. That's allowed to. That's a random order in which you're attaching, pairing the half edges. But it gives you the same law in the end. That's very nice. All right. Any more questions about the configuration model? Okay. Now, this is the kind of properties that I would like to have. Right? I had these degree sequences in my real-world networks that were heavy-tailed. So I want to put that into my model, because that actually makes the model more realistic. So you can think of these degrees as being IID, for example, and then the probability that the degree is larger than K should fall off like an inverse power of K. You can also ask the same thing for the probability mass function. That's a bit more restrictive. So we typically look at tail probabilities. Now, if I take a very nice set of IID degrees, and I look at the empirical distribution of the various values, so now we're back in the land of statistics and empirical distributions, you can do the same thing as what we were doing previously in the real-world networks, namely make a log-log plot of how many times you see certain values, and what you get is pictures like this. And these, of course, look a lot like the pictures we've seen previously. For example, you have something like that becomes a bit wider at the end for the large values. I always think of these as corresponding to stochastic fluctuations. And you see that, of course, in the proper stochastic setting as well, where here at the tail of the distribution, where you're talking about sort of very few vertices that have such large degrees, you see that it becomes a bit wider, and some occur, some do not occur. Okay?
What does the wideness mean on that? If you go back several slides, when you showed the wideness toward the bottom, what did that...
For example, here.
Yeah, there.
Here.
Right.
You see this bar?
Yeah.
Okay? This is the minimal proportion that you could have.
Yeah.
Which is 1 over the network size.
Yeah.
So this means that all of these degrees, and of course these points are pretty thick,
yeah,
so they start overlapping and becoming a line, all of these correspond to certain values of the degrees,
uh-huh,
that only occur once. And these correspond to values of the degrees that occur precisely twice. And this occurs... Okay, so that's...
This is really a 1. I mean,
yeah,
really
yeah, yeah. But because you're doing things in log-log scale, actually 1 over n is still visible in the picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's many packers who have a million... Well, it's the other end.
What?
The degree is supposed to be the number of actors that have played in the same film.
Yeah. Yes. So these values go up to pretty big values. But you're right, it looks a bit big. I'm wondering whether I made an error in rescaling my picture.
Something deceptive because, yeah. I mean, of course, if one actor is 49,011 and another actor is 49,084, I mean, yeah. They're not going to be the same number.
Yeah, precisely.
Right.
And this is one reason why sometimes people look at tail distributions rather than...
I was going to say, tail
right.
would be more indicative than that.
True. All right. So, if I look at the configuration model, I can take the degree sequence to be anything I like. So, the scale-free behavior of the tail distribution is already built into the model. So, there's nothing to explain there. Right? So, the other thing that I might want to be interested in is this small world property. So that is not put into the model, so you need to prove something there just to indicate what the graph distances behave like when the network becomes very big. So, of course, distances in larger graphs will become large. The question is how large? So if I look at, for example, a square and I take two vertices uniformly at random, if the square contains n points, then the distance will typically be of the order square root of n. So that actually grows quite quickly with n. Now what we see in many of these networks is that the growth with n is much smaller, much slower. And that's indicated here in this very first theorem where the graph distance grows logarithmically with a certain base. And here this hn is precisely the random variable of which I was drawing these probability mass functions previously. Namely, it's a graph distance between the uniform pairs of pair of vertices in the graph. That's what it is. And this first theorem says that if a certain quantity that is related to the degree sequence, the expected value of the degree times the degree minus 1 over the expected value of the degree, if that is in between 1 and infinity, but infinity not included, then the graph distances grow logarithmically. Okay? This being larger than 1 actually turns out to be equivalent to there being a giant component in the graph. If this quantity is less than or equal to 1, there will not be a giant component, and this is very closely related to a critical Erdős-Renyi random graph. Right? In real-world networks, we typically do see a giant component. Sometimes the thing is actually connected. For example, in internet would not be very useful if it wouldn't be connected, right? Because we use it to send emails. Okay, so you should think of this condition as basically two parts. The first part says that actually the something like an average forward degree is larger than 1, which guarantees that there is a giant component. The second thing also says that the expected value of the degree squared has to be finite. So this is the setting where you have finite variance degrees. So if you believe in power laws, this corresponds to the power law being strictly larger than 3, which sometimes does show up in empirical studies, and sometimes these exponents are in between 2 and 3. So when this exponent is in between 2 and 3, you see different behavior, and what you see is that the graph distance does not grow like log n, but it grows like log log n. Now that really is very slow. So in any practical sort of computation, you will not be able to tell the difference between log log n and a constant. And that's indicated in this picture. So this is log. I do see that it tends to infinity. It's a bit difficult to see, but this is log log. Now if I go and stand over there, I will be able to see that it grows. But you will not be able to tell this apart from a constant, right? That might be an explanation of 6 degrees of separation. Yes, Lutz.
How important is this IID assumption?
Not at all. you do need some regularity of the degrees. For example, weak convergence of, the random variable that you get by looking at the degree of a uniform vertex, and maybe convergence of some of its moments, or its tail distribution, to have results like this. The strongest results have been proved in the IID setting. But it's not really important. These results, for example, have only been shown in the IID setting. So what these last lines say, that not only do we have convergence in probability of these ratios, of course you could also look at the difference between these things. So in the first case, Hn minus the log nu of n. And it turns out that that is a tight sequence of random variables. So the fluctuations are very small. But it's a bit of a weird thing, right? Because this actually is an integer, whereas this is, might not be. Now you might think to resolve that by taking the seals or floors or so, and then actually you do get an integer random variable, which is tight, but it doesn't converge. Somehow the thing wants to be close to the log, but the log is not integer, and therefore you have these periodicity effects. So this is an example of a random variable that is tight, but it actually does not converge. But in this case, we can actually characterize all the possible limiting sequences. And for example, here, if you go along an appropriately chosen exponentially growing sequence, you will get convergence along that sequence to a specific value, but that value will depend on the precise sequence that you've chosen. Okay? That's a bit of a weird setting. And the same thing is true here. Okay? So we see... Yes?
So when tau is exactly 3, the operator on both are...
It depends on slowly varying functions that are inside the tail behavior. For example, when tau is 3, this could still be finite, and then this applies. But if we assume that there's no slowly varying function, so it's really like the tail probability is like 1 over x squared, then the distances are log n over log log n. And this is known, but it's not so easy to find it. All right. Any questions about this? So this is a way to view, let's say, 6 degrees of separation in real-world networks, or at least models for them. Okay? So one slide about the preferential attachment model. So the preferential attachment model, as I said, is a dynamic model. So you start with one vertex, then another vertex comes in, it decides where it wants to send its edges, then a third vertex comes in, it decides where it wants to send its edges, etc., etc. So we're here in a very simple setting where every vertex comes in with a fixed amount of edges. That's denoted by m. So that means that a vertex comes in, it has m edges, it wants to give those to vertices that are already in the graph, and the question is, how should it do that? Now, the idea of preferential attachment is that it will do it proportional to the degrees of the vertices that are already in the graph plus a constant. This is sometimes called an affine rule. And this is closely related, of course, to the talk of Mike Steele. He was not taking in this delta, but I've understood that in the paper you actually do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a reason to put in this constant, because what you see is that this behavior, which is sometimes called the rich get richer phenomenon, but I would more appropriately call it the old get rich phenomenon. The vertices that have a very high degree are more likely to grab even more of the edges that are coming in later in the game. So vertices with high degree get even higher degrees. Now, I'm calling this the old get rich phenomenon because it actually turns out that the vertices with very high degree are the ones that are old, the ones that were there the earliest. So the maximum degree, for example, is realized by a vertex whose label is actually tight. So it's the first, or it's the second, or it's the third, or it's the fourth. Right? But the probability that it's the millionth is actually very small. No? Now, you may wonder why I put this in. So there's a very famous paper by Albert and Barabasi who proposed this model with delta being equal to zero. But then the bad thing about that model is that it will yield power laws, as you can see in this picture, but if delta is equal to zero, the power law is always 3. And that's a bit poor, because in real-world examples, we actually see various power laws appearing. So we want the model to be a bit more flexible, and we want the model to be such that any parallel can be realized. So by taking in this delta, we can actually realize any parallel exponent larger than 2. And larger than 2 means that the mean will be finite. Of course, that's being put into the model. Every vertex comes in with m edges. So the average degree will be 2m. Yeah? So that explains why it's larger than 2. But there is a regime, for example, where the degree is in between 2 and 3. That corresponds to infinite variance degrees. So this extra additive factor here, the delta, allows you to be more flexible in the precise degree sequences. And the funny thing is that despite the fact that this is a completely different model, the behavior of degrees is very similar to what we see in the configuration model with the same degree sequence. So again, we see here that if this tau is larger than 3, then you see distances that are of the order logarithmic in the network size, in t. Whereas if this value is in between 2 and 3, the graph distances grow like a log-log. So this at least has a bit of the flavor of the universality that I was after. It gives sort of consistent predictions, even though constants will be different. It gives consistent predictions for the behavior of the graph distances. All right? Any questions about this?
So, if you take m is 100, but if you take delta equals 10,
yep.
It's kind of helping out people at the start. I mean, that they don't lag behind or something like
yeah.
that.
So, if you take delta to be extremely large,
yeah.
then at least initially you're not going to notice the effect of the degrees.
Yeah.
So then it's like a uniform recursive tree.
Yeah.
And a uniform recursive tree is well known, has a geometrically decaying degree sequence. So that actually indicates that if delta is very large, then somehow the tail should become much thinner.
Yeah.
Whereas if delta is negative, you somehow enforce or enhance the effect of the large degrees. Because, you know, if my degree is 100 and I subtract of 1, I'm not going to notice it. But if my degree is 2, then I lose half my capacity.
What happens when delta is negative and it becomes that term becomes negative? You just don't go there.
Yeah, no, that's not allowed because I'm actually taking delta to be larger than minus m, and all the degrees are at least m. So this is always positive.
Why are all the degrees at least m?
Because every vertex comes in with m edges, right?
Oh.
There we go. very good questions, by the way. And of course, I should mention that Joel was involved in proving this scale-free behavior when delta is actually equal to 0. That's the original Albert Barabasi model. All right. Any questions? Further questions about this? Okay. So, yeah.
Let me ask about the robustness of this. I mean,
yes.
How much does the initial configuration affect the results of these models?
It depends on what the questions are that you're asking.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you look at the maximum degree,
yeah.
it's going to be heavily affected.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there's even difference between the model where you allow for self-loops
yeah.
or you do not allow for self-loops. The distribution of, I mean, the scaling of the maximal degree will be the same, but the precise limiting distribution will be different. We'll have different moments. But for example, for the graph distances, it makes no difference whatsoever. So we actually do it for several versions. There's at least 3 different versions that you can think about. I mean, if you have m is 3, you could update your degree sequence while you're attaching, or you could not. It makes no difference whatsoever for graph distances. Yeah. All right. So I promised to talk about information diffusion on random graphs. So far I've only talked about the topology of random graphs in terms of their degree sequences and their graph distances. So I want to focus on one particular example of information diffusion, and we call these competition processes. So think you have a network, and there's 2 competing products that are trying to grab the market. And they're located somewhere in the graph. I'm just going to assume that this is somehow uniform in the graph. And they have some sort of a mechanism, a viral marketing mechanism maybe, of spreading the product to neighbors. So you could think of this as being the spread of a disease, for example, or the spread of a rumor. But of course, I mean, certainly when we're dealing with expensive products, think about a Microsoft computer or laptop or an Apple, people will only buy one. Okay? So once a person has decided whether he's going to use Apple or Microsoft, then they're going to be like that at least for a certain amount of time. Right? So that's what the competition is all about. If I have friends that are very persuasive and persuade me to buy an Apple, then I will actually stick to that Apple for a certain number of years because it's an expensive product. So this is what the competition says. I mean, if you would have two different diseases that are spreading on the graph, well, you know, a person can have the two diseases at the same time. But for a laptop, this is less usual. So that's the competition aspect. And this, of course, is very important in viral marketing, for example. And one of the observations we see, but this may also be a personal opinion, is that it's not always the case that the best product grabs the entire market. Of course, this depends on what you call the best product. This may be personal. But, it sort of raises the question, what determines who is going to grab the majority of the market? And is it actually possible that the two products grab a large proportion of the market simultaneously? So this is very closely related to models in statistical physics. If the two would grab a large proportion of the market, this would be called coexistence. And we know that there are settings where you have coexistence, and we know that there are settings where you do not. And what we would like to get out is conditions on when to have coexistence and when not. All right. So what is our setting? We model our social network as a random graph. That's what I've been trying to explain before. And we model the dynamics as competing rumors that are spreading through the network. So if I've heard rumor type 1, then I'm not going to listen to rumor type 2. That's the competition aspect. Yeah? I'm guessing that you can find a good example of this in terms of elections that may be appropriate for the Americans here. And so these different rumors might spread at different speeds. A rumor might be juicier than another. Or a product might be more... might be better in conveying the information that you should buy it, right? It might be more attractive. So the way how I view it is that the fastest type could correspond to the best possible product. And now the question is, does the fastest, the best product also grab the entire market or not? And how does this depend on where the vertices start, where the viral marketing campaign starts from, as well as what the precise spreading dynamics is? Is the question clear? Okay. Now, of course, this is very closely related to the spread of rumors, because you know if these viral marketing campaigns are starting pretty far away from each other, initially they're not going to see each other, and then it's precisely the same as a rumor spreading through your graph. So let's spend a few words on that. So in absence of the competition, the dynamics is a rumor spread on the graph, and the central role for the spreading dynamics of such rumors, which we model as first passage percolation on a graph, where we're putting in some traversal times along edges, which are going to be IID random variables. And in this talk, they could either be exponentially distributed, that's always very nice because of the memoryless property, or they could be deterministic. So if I have bought an apple, and you're my friend, next week you're going to buy an apple. That's basically the idea, right? And then, certainly for rumor spread, the main object of study is the weight of the smallest weight path between two uniformly connected vertices. So what do? You look at the CN quantity. You take the minimum of raw paths in the graph. So that's where the topology enters. Between the first vertex and the second vertex, here denoted by U1 and U2. And you take the weight of that path, and that's just the same thing as the sum over the edge weights for the edges in the graph. And I will be assuming that these weights are a collection of IID random variables. Now, if I were to do this on ZD, this would precisely give me first passage percolation on ZD. This is a model that has been investigated a lot. The model clear?
Good.
So, I was saying that there's two different spreading mechanisms, a deterministic spreading mechanism and an exponential or Markovian spreading dynamics. And there's a reason to this, because what you see is rather different behavior in the two cases. So in the deterministic spreading, I might as well assume that the traversal time for one of the types is 1, and the traversal time for the other is greater than or equal to 1. Okay? Now, first, the setting where the second species really is slower. It will take it longer to traverse an edge. Now, then you might gather that, because the graph is extremely large, the first type will basically grab everything. Okay? And that turns out to be true. So this N1 of N is the number of vertices that species 1 takes, or that byproduct 1, and N2 is the number of vertices that byproduct 2. And N1 of N divided by N converges in probability to 1. Bear in mind that we're in a situation where the graph is almost completely connected. Of course, if there would be a giant component that is much smaller, it would just basically grab the giant component when you would start in it. But I've been assuming that the degrees here are at least 2. And in that case, actually, the whole thing is to a large extent connected. Okay? So the fastest species grabs the majority of the market. That's the message here. And actually, we can quantify how much the losing type gets. And we take a log here. So it's basically of the order e to the power a log, a power of a log, where the power is smaller than 1. That's not a lot. That's much smaller than any power of n. No? All right. Now, the interesting case, of course, is when the products are comparable. Who's going to win? Is there one going to win?
Can we explain the theorem? Because the first type gets to the...
Yes, we'll get to that.
Large degree vertices first.
It's actually, I mean, in this whole game, the type that gets to the largest degrees first, there's a little bit of, I mean, there might be multiple vertices of basically the same degree, so then it might, there's a little bit there. But the type that gets to the largest degrees first will basically grab the entire market. That's the whole point. And if you're a bit faster, then you'll get there earlier, and therefore you grab the entire market. Yeah. Now, when you have deterministic spreading, but they go equally fast, the same picture arises. But actually, because they go equally fast, they might actually get there at the same time, or roughly the same time, or they might get there at a different time. So when one of them gets to this high degree vertices first, that product will grab the entire market. When they get there at the same time, they will actually coexist and both grab a large proportion of the market. And both are possible. And we can actually compute explicitly the limiting possibility for each of the two scenarios to occur. Okay? So that's what this says. If I look at the number of vertices that are found by product 1, or the number of people who buy product 1, if I divide that through by n, this will converge in distribution to a random variable. It's very trivial. It's either 0 or 1. So all or nothing, basically. And the number of vertices for the losing type, when actually it's 0 or 1, and this is when the starting locations of the types are sufficiently different, whatever that means. So this basically corresponds to one product actually grabbing the highest degree vertices first. In that setting, there's one winner, and the loser gets a much smaller amount, which is basically a power of n with an exponent that is strictly smaller than 1. So that's this first statement. In the second statement, when these two sort of competing processes arrive at the high degree vertices at the same time, then actually both get a proportion of the market. So that means that both N1 of N divided by N and N2 of N divided by N are strictly positive and strictly smaller than 1. So that's coexistence.
Can you say what sufficiency is different? If I find a market,
yes.
Where should it start?
Yes, good point. I'm not sure whether I'll get to that, but we can quantify this. And it's related to the precise growth locally. So that's sometimes called location, 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 right? Yeah. But this can be quantified explicitly because in these random graph models, we're locally tree-like, so we look like a branching process. But here we're in the setting where tau is in between 2 and 3, and then it turns out that the branching process is infinite mean. And in such infinite mean branching processes, the growth is not exponential, as it is for finite mean, but it's super exponential. e to the power something. And there's a random variable involved there, and that random variable determines everything. So if the, so each of the two types has their own random variable. If this ratio between them is sufficiently close to 1, then you have coexistence. If it's very far away from 1, either smaller than 1 or larger than 1, then 1 will basically grab everything.
And you have a sharp threshold?
A sharp threshold, yeah. The ratio has to be in between, well, if you order them from large to big, it has to be smaller than 1 over tall minus 2. That's it. All right, so this was the setting of deterministic spreading, and in a certain sense this is good news, because in the deterministic spreading setting, at least the fastest product wins. Right? And I was thinking of the fastest product as being the best product. So at least the best product actually grabs the majority of the market. When they're equally good, actually, I mean, who cares, right? At least from a societal relevance aspect, it doesn't really matter. Now, it becomes much more disturbing when we put in Markovian spreading. And Markovian spreading means that the traversal times are exponential random variables. This is a particularly nice setting because actually the expiration process becomes Markovian. That's quite nice. That's a memoryless property. And then it turns out that the number of vertices found by product 1 divided by n again converges in distribution to a Bernoulli variable. It's either 0 or 1. And this is true regardless of whether it's the fastest or the slowest spreading type. So also the worst product can actually grab the majority of the market. And not only that, actually the losing type, which could actually correspond to the best product, only gets a finite number of customers. That's pretty bad. Yeah? And all of this is being determined by location and also the traversal times close to you, because somehow these exponential random variables play a very important role. So this is written together with Mia Dijven, who's Swedish, and we thought it would be appropriate to use an ABBA song for this paper. So we called it "The Winner Takes It All," and actually this second result can be phrased as "The Loser Standing Small," which is the second line of the lyrics of this song. All right. Oh, the wrong way around. So I don't have a lot of time.
7 minutes.
Oh, 7 minutes. Okay. So the main idea behind the proofs here is to compare things to trees. So the locally tree-like nature of these graphs is again very important. But there's something weird happening. I was already mentioning that the branching process will have infinite mean. But the degree sequence has infinite variance. So what is happening there? So there's a size biasing that is taking place in this graph exploration. And that is basically due to the fact that if I have a half edge and I'm going to attach it to another vertex, if I look at the degree of that, well, if the degree is very large, I'm more likely to choose it. How much more likely am I going to choose it? Well, precisely proportional to its degree. So if I look at how half edges are being paired, they're going to be paired to vertices that don't have the original degree distribution, but have the size bias degree distribution. And then by pairing, you're losing one, because you eat up one of its half edges. So that describes how the branching process occurs. And it describes that if I look at the forward degree of a vertex that is a neighbor of, let's say, my starting point, then that degree distribution is something like a size bias version minus one. Right? Vertices with high degree are more likely to be paired to. It's not uniform pairing here. Contrary to the Erdős-Rényi random graph, for example. In the Erdős-Rényi random graph, everything is exchangeable, and therefore every vertex is equally likely to be chosen. That's not true here. Okay? So because of the size biasing, it immediately means that if I start with a degree distribution that has infinite variance, I size bias it, it has infinite mean. Okay? So that's where the shift in the moments comes from. So this computation is done here for one neighbor of a vertex. But in particular, it implies that when the mean of the degree distribution is finite, that the number of half edges that is being eaten up in this process is a bounded random variable. It's actually a tight random variable. So that means that after I've paired one half edge, almost all the half edges are still there. So nothing really has changed in that respect. So if I pair the second half edge, it's basically going to be paired to a random to a vertex with a random number of half edges, and that number of half edges is going to be an IID copy of the first one, apart from minor corrections. Well, that's the branching process. That's very closely related to what Joel was describing in his breadth-first exploration. This actually is a breadth-first exploration, and you can write it down explicitly. Okay, so this basically means that if I look at the graph and look at a neighborhood in the graph, bear in mind here it's very important that we're allowed to pair the half edges as we see them coming. So I start with a U1 that has degree 4. Now I pair this one to a vertex. This has a certain degree distribution. In this case it has degree 6. If I'm going to be pairing this one, so the law of this random variable is very closely related to this size bias degree minus 1, and because this actually is a small amount, and I have in total of the order n half edges, it actually will not affect the choice of the vertex here. Okay? So this is basically going to be an IID copy, again, of d star minus 1. So this is the locally tree-like behavior, but it actually is a locally sort of homogeneous branching process property. That's stronger than a tree-like behavior. Okay? All right. So how about this locally tree-like behavior? Well, we're dealing here with infinite mean branching processes, and these infinite mean branching processes are special, as I already alluded to before, in the sense that they grow doubly exponentially. So if I look at the log of the number of vertices that are distance k from my initial starting point, if I multiply that by something which decays exponentially, then that limit will exist, almost surely, and it will be some random variable. It's actually unclear what the properties of this random variable are. There's quite a few results about it, but for example, we don't know precisely when this has a density. One of the things that we don't know. Okay, but it's some random variable that's strictly in between 0 and infinity. And as Rick was saying quite correctly, it's a type that reaches the vertices of highest degree, the hubs, first, that wins. Now, in the absence of competition, it will take each of the types about log log n over the absolute value of log tall minus 2 steps to reach the vertex of maximum degree. Why is that? Well, if k here is of this order, and if you somehow rewrite this equation as saying that zk is roughly e to the power y times tall minus 2 to the power minus k, so this is now exponentially growing, so this is the number of vertices at distance k from my root in the tree, and it grows like this, right? If I want this to be of the order n, let's say order n to some power alpha, then actually k has to be log log n divided by the absolute value of log tall minus 2. And actually, it's very sensitive, because if for one k it's alpha, for the next k it will be alpha over tall minus 2. That's a larger power. And then it will become alpha divided by log alpha divided by tall minus 2 squared. So this goes very rapidly. In a few steps, you go from n to the power 1 millionth to n to the power 2. Which, of course, is completely impossible, because our graph has only n vertices. So you have to be very careful there. But that's basically the idea. So this basically says that it takes you a deterministic amount of steps to get to the vertices of highest degree. So if the time it takes you to go through an edge is different, the one that goes through there fastest will get to the highest degree vertices first. But it's not so clear what happens when they actually spread at the same time. It actually depends sensitively on this y. If this y is extremely large, it's sort of like you're a few steps ahead of your competitor. Right? And then you get to the highest degree vertices first. And actually this is why the ratio of tall minus 2 is precisely the relevant thing. If the ratio is at least 1 over tall minus 2, you're one step ahead. If you're one step ahead, you'll get to the maximum degree vertices first. And you've won. Okay? That's the idea. Yeah. Right. I will not say anything about this and go to the conclusions. So I believe that networks are useful to interpret all sorts of real-world phenomena. And I've given the example of competition in a graph. Another thing that I've tried to highlight is that there is unexpected commonality in many of the real-world networks that we see. Many of them are scale-free. Many of them are small worlds. And we use random graphs in order to model these networks. And these random graph models are then used to explain properties of real-world networks, such as the small world phenomenon or other things. And, of course, the important question is universality, and I've already highlighted the fact that, at least in terms of distances, there is a rather universal behavior. I would like to draw some attention to the poster of Alessandro Garavaglia, who is sitting over there. And this poster is about diameters in scale-free configuration models and preferential attachment models. And this is in the case where the degree exponent is in between 2 and 3 again. Then we know that the typical distances are log-log. And what we prove is that also the diameter scales like log-log, at least when the minimal degree is sufficiently large. And we can explicitly compute the constant, both for preferential attachment model and for the configuration model. Another poster is by Clara Stegenhuis, who is sitting over there. And this is a poster on an attempt of building a model that is slightly more realistic than the configuration model. Because, of course, it's beautiful that we can analyze the configuration model because it's so locally tree-like, but real-world networks really are not locally tree-like. Right? So what we are trying to do there is to build a model that somehow locally is not tree-like, but on a global perspective is. So, a book in preparation that some of you may have seen on my website, an update on this, it's sent to the publisher, it will appear this year. But it will still remain on being on my website, the PDF version. So have a look at it. Thank you very much.
Question?
Yes.
With this result
for this competition, yep.
Do you think it would be very different if you would have more than two competitors?
No. The analysis might. In fact, in the Markovian spreading, we've done that. And basically, the same picture remains. In the deterministic spreading, it's a bit more complicated because we really have to, certainly when the speeds are equal, because we have to analyze very precisely the moment when they're trying to grab the highest degree vertices. Now, if you have 25 colors all trying to grab the same, it might become a bit hairy. But I think that the same picture basically still persists. But it could be that when you have 25 colors, that 23 of them coexist, whereas two are left out, or something like that. So. Good question.
Do you know what happens if you have the network growing at the same time as something spreading on the network?
Ah, yes. These are fascinating questions. Yes. There's a lot of interest in that in the physics community. I believe that this is one of the problems that we should start thinking about as mathematicians as well. Now, it's very... it's quite complicated. For example, I mean, the simplest possible process that could spread on a graph is a random walk, right? So what happens when a random walk spreads on a graph that changes dynamically? For example, its marginal distribution is always an Erdős-Rényi random graph, but somehow it does change in time. Well, that's not so clear. How does that affect the mixing time? Will it mix faster? Will it mix slower? Huh? Good questions.
One more question.
Just a comment about... when you mentioned, of course, the Erdős-Rényi results as being a static model, which is completely true.
Yep.
However, I'd like to point out that in the very title was on the evolution of random graphs. So right at the very start, they were thinking of it in terms of a dynamic model.
Yes. Yes and no.
Yes and no.
So, I mean, of course, this is a dynamic process by adding edges. That's a beautiful picture, by the way, that is very enlightening. But it's not dynamic in the number of vertices. And that's the kind of dynamics that I'm interested in. I'm thinking of my network as growing in time. Of course, you can reformulate the Erdős-Rényi random graph also as a dynamic model where you add vertices and remove edges. But it may be less natural. It's certainly not what they did. Yeah.
Very well. Thank you very much. Let's thank the speaker. We'll be starting.